This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Joseph Kelly. He's the author of a book called Marooned, Jamestown, Shipwreck, and a New History of America's Origin. And as a reader of American history, I thought this book was a very interesting book. And so I'm really happy to talk to you, Joe, about it today. Thanks for being on this show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity, David.
Well, I have to ask you the very first question. I know you're a historian and you teach history at the College of Charleston, but I'm interested to know what put you onto the Jamestown story. You obviously spent many years of research on this, so I assume it mattered to you, but I'm really curious about what got you started to study Jamestown Colony.
Yeah, it actually happened kind of organically, and really, I'm from a literature background. I'm not from a history background. I've taught myself to be a historian, you know, in the last 15 years or so. And this is the second kind of straight historical narrative that I've written. I felt like I taught myself to do it in my first book, and then you know, this one I knew what I was doing. But it started as a course that I taught with a colleague of mine, Rich Bodak, here at the College of Charleston, who is a historian, and it was in the Honors College where they allow us to do these interdisciplinary courses that just kind of follow whatever kind of, you know, wherever our curiosity is leading. And I don't know, this must have been a dozen years or so, back when the TV program Lost was really big and Survivor was huge, you know, that reality show.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, just kind of fascinated by this phenomenon that people seem to be, you know, captivated by the story of castaways and the whole situation of people marooned on a desert island or in some wilderness landscape. So we decided to design a course. We ended up teaching it every 2 years for 3 years, so three times. So I think over the course of 6 or 7 years, we taught this course three times and modified it a little bit each time. We had Gilligan's Island in the first year that proved to be an unteachable thing, so we dropped it by the second time we taught it. But that's like, you know, we were doing pop culture stuff. We were doing Robinson Crusoe. We were doing the Odyssey. And by the time we got to the third time we taught this course, I had persuaded myself that I thought this was really the reason that we were so fascinated by these stories and keep telling ourselves castaway and maroonage tales is because it's the real foundation myth of American democracy. So I set out to write a book about that was going to kind of follow the syllabus of our course. It was going to talk about, you know, how American culture has used maroon tales in various periods. And the first one was going to be this tale of shipwreck, this fantastic tale of shipwreck in 1609, 1610, that ended up being, you know, kind of inspiration for Shakespeare's Tempest. And, you know, so this is the first couple of years, you know, 2 years into the Jamestown colony. So right at the start of the American, you know, enterprise, England's overseas enterprise in the Americas.
It was one of the supply ships. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. It was the flagship of the third supply, which was actually a fleet of 9 ships. This is going to, you know, the first couple of years of Jamestown is really torturous, and the first part of my book deals with what happens there. You know, that, and that's where we get the tales we know about John Smith and Pocahontas, for instance, and that kind of thing. But this was meant to, you know, resuscitate the colony that was basically on life support and barely surviving. It was going to bring 500 new settlers. The first wave of settlers brought about 100 people, and within 6 months, that had been whittled down to 50. So, you know, and then the first and second supplies were similar cases. So this was going to really transform Jamestown into basically an English town. You know, they had carpenters and they had shipwrights and they had women, you know, they had livestock. So it was going to take Jamestown from being kind of a garrison fortress and turn it into an English village. And but they shipwreck, you know, that's the central tale, which my book begins with. And then I kind of backtrack a little bit. And then I pick up that thread about halfway through again, is the shipwreck that happens in the mid-Atlantic in 1609. And So when I was writing the book, you know, that was going to be chapter one, and it didn't take me long in researching it to realize that was the entire book. You know, that this is not a story that could be told in 30 pages. You know, and 130,000 words later, it's the entire thing.
Right. So in other words, and I read that chapter the section of the book that's about that shipwreck is just an amazing story. And I actually do agree in a way that could be a book unto itself. The story of what they did and how they survived and then how they pursued leaving the island is just unbelievable.
Oh yeah. It is. It's stranger than fiction. And it, you know, it plays out like an episode of Survivor too. You know, there's rival camps on different islands, and you know, there's all sorts of you know, animosity and conflict between everyone. There's four distinct, you know, what the Virginia Company describes as mutinies on the island, some bigger than others, but all kind of threatening what happened, you know, the whole the plans of the Virginia Company.
Right. It's Lord of the Flies in real life.
You know, yes and no. And here's the thing. So the other books have been written on this subject. It's not like people don't know about it. And obviously everybody knows about Jamestown. That's been written about, you know, quite a bit. And the 400th anniversary was back in 2007. So a lot of books came out then. But almost everybody, really everybody, some people are maybe a little more sensitive than others, but all of the histories are hugely influenced by the point of view of the people who wrote the narratives. And the people who wrote the narratives were basically the executives of the Virginia Company. So we have these, you know, these kind of traditional notions about what happened in Jamestown, which renders Jamestown, you know, I think of Jamestown as kind of the redheaded stepchild of American history. Everybody knows it happened before Plymouth Plantation up in Massachusetts, but, you know, compared to that golden child that is the Pilgrims colony up in Massachusetts, Jamestown is a disaster, right? So if anything, we study Jamestown as a cautionary tale, and then we think of the Pilgrims as our you know, mythical origin of the nation. What I'm doing and what really fascinated me about this, despite the fact that a lot of other people have paid attention to this episode in American history, is that nobody has told the story from the point of view of the common settlers. And they are always, as a result, cast as, at best, you know, idle ne'er-do-wells who are after a quick buck and are just too lazy to actually plant something in the ground or throw a net into the river to try to put food on their own table. You know, this is the way they're usually characterized. Above all else, they're unruly. They will not be governed. That's not really what happened. That's the story as we get it from the point of view of the Virginia Company itself. So when they call somebody idle, what they really mean is that they're not taking orders from the Virginia Company. There's nobody who was idle, you know, on these excursions. I mean, lazy people did not get on these ships and go to America. So what I'm trying to do is tell a story about what happens when people are marooned. And that's why the title of the book is Marooned. That is a really important concept. And this is what contrasts what happened in the shipwreck and what happened in Jamestown generally, distinguishes it from what happened up in Massachusetts.
Right. And I think that is actually one of the crucial points of your book, is that you are able to pursue this idea of the untold story. But I'd also argue that it's probably a common problem in all of the history of that period, because it's always written by those of a class high enough to have the ability to write, their stories to be preserved and passed down. Although you also, I thought the other crucial point, or another, not the only other, but another crucial point was your telling of John Smith's story, because he is one of those individuals who was not he didn't come from the upper class. And you talk about how there was a certain porousness between the classes, that some could rise and some could fall at any given time, maybe smaller numbers. But the Smith is able to tell a different story. And in the letters that he writes back to the Virginia Company, he does give a different narrative perspective to the owners or to the investors.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was pretty important that he, you know, and of course you talk about him a lot. So, you know, that there's a portrait of him that really emerges in this book, I think.
Yes. And it's somewhat different than the John Smith that probably most of your listeners are familiar with. I mean, he is rightly one of the most fascinating characters in American history. I think he's wrongly often characterized as the first American. There's some things that he does in Jamestown that get interpreted as being very much pro-democracy, anti-aristocracy, essentially pro-meritocracy. You know, he has this very famous pronouncement where he says, when he becomes president of the Jamestown colony, he says, he who does not work will not eat, you know, and that's often interpreted as, okay, here's the first pronouncement of an American as opposed to a European doctrine. And that's usually thought of as looking at the gentlemen who have come to settle Jamestown and are not used to doing physical labor. And he's telling them, if you don't do any, then you're not going to get any food. That's not really, you know, when you look at that, his statement in context, that's not really what he means, because he has both gentlemen and commoners who are in his faction, and he is talking to another faction that is in Jamestown, which is made up also of commoners and gentlemen as well. So that statement doesn't end up, you know, if you look at it in context, it's not really the kind of the class, almost revolutionary statement that we think of that it is.
No,
on the other hand,
go ahead.
Yeah. On the other hand, he really is, you know, he is a very remarkable figure in, Elizabethan and early Jacobean England, because he is one of those few people like Shakespeare himself, you know, who rises from, you know, what I call the 98% versus the 2%, to kind of, you know, give an echo to what we think of as the 1% and the 99% today. 2% of England's population belonged to the gentry, the gentleman class. They had crossed over that absolutely crucial line where you can get a coat of arms, and by virtue of having that coat of arms, you were distinguished from the rest of the population. Certain people in this period, you know, it's a whole lot more, mobility in the late 15, early 1600s than obtained earlier in England's history. So it is true that there's a fair amount of mobility, and he's one of those figures who goes from being a commoner to being a gentleman. But once he becomes a gentleman, you know, he's not a leveler. He's not like, okay, let's get rid of this distinction between gentlemen and commoners. He is very jealously guards the privileges that go along with his shield, which has the heads of three Turks on it. You know, that's how he earned his status in battle, by slaying three Turks back in the East in European wars against Turkey. And he's very proud of that and is not going to give up on it. But he is this, he challenges the Virginia Company because of the incompetences that he sees. And there's so much incompetence and infighting in the structure of Jamestown's governance in the first couple of years before the shipwreck happens. As a matter of fact, John Smith arrives in chains and expects to get executed shortly after they step ashore on the Chesapeake. And there's a secret box that is in the captain's cabin that the Virginia Company has given secret instructions that are not to be open until they set foot in America. And when they open up that box, lo and behold, his name is among the names of the appointed counselors. No one knew who was going to be the government, but John Smith is appointed to the government. So you know, he becomes untouchable then. You can't execute him. So right from the very beginning, there's this kind of survivor-like infighting between you know, the Blue Tribe and the Red Tribe, if you will, and Jamestown. And what happens because of that, you know, we very quickly, the common settlers, or a lot of the common settlers, and some gentlemen as well, recognize that if they just acquiesce to the plans of the Virginia Company, they're going to die. As I said, you know, about 100 people get put ashore in April, and you know, early summer the ships go back to England. So these people are essentially, you know, they're not literally shipwrecked, but they're essentially marooned in this vast continent by themselves on this little, you know, Jamestown Island, which is really this little swampy, marshy peninsula. And they're left to their own devices until the ships come back, you know. So what happens is, you know, they try to start trading for food with the Indians, but they're not very successful at it. They're incompetent. People start suffering from malnutrition, disease hits, of course, because of semi-tropical diseases that Europeans have not been exposed to before. And by the time we get to September or August, you know, about half the people have died. So the remainder are looking around saying, you know, if we're going to live, we have to get out of here. And they start defecting. They run away to go live with the Indians. And this is always characterized in the narratives as a betrayal of not only of England, but of Christianity as well. It's incomprehensible to the leaders of the Virginia Company, the officers who have been appointed, that anybody would do this, because it seems like you're going to live with devil worshipers. But it makes perfect sense, of course, if you're staring, you know, stay in the garrisoned palisade that is Jamestown and die, or take your own life into your own hands, take responsibility for your own life, and essentially steal yourself away and go out into the wilderness and start a life anew.
Well, and what that made me think about a lot is that, you know, essentially Jamestown Colony is founded on a kind of corporate oligarchy model.
Yeah.
And these people who defected were essentially saying, having learned what it meant to be essentially a wage slave with no rights and no freedom, that they could contrast their own style of living, the European style of living, with the Native American style, which was, you know, it was still a
much more attractive,
attractive. I mean, you know, it's not to say that I think there's a, you know, you talked about, I think the, you know, the kind of European romanticism about American Indians. So we all suffer or share some of those historical failures of understanding, because they've been passed down to us in the same way that, you know, our historical understanding of Jamestown and of Plymouth, for that matter, are probably inaccurate. But clearly, it's like the business structure model of the British was pretty obviously not going to work. And, or at least at that stage, wasn't going to work. And a lot of what you document is that a lot of the, there was a sort of a porousness to the society.
Oh yeah. It's what, you know, a historian slash anthropologist, Richard White, wrote about back in the early 1990s, which he called the middle ground, which really kind of modified and in many ways kind of resuscitated the old frontier thesis of American civilization. You know, the frontier thesis held that it was the encounter with the frontier that transformed Europeans into a different kind of person than they were back in the old world. And you know, this is one way of describing what's often called American exceptionalism, right? We are different than Europeans because of that confrontation with the frontier. And this theory was first promulgated when the frontier was pronounced to be closed in, you know, around 1890.
Right, Frederick Jackson.
Right, yes. And then, you know, that theory kind of went out of fashion a little bit, but I think Richard White's work has resurrected with much more sensitivity. I mean, if you go back and read Turner. I mean, there's some, you know, horribly embarrassing, you know, racist passages and that kind of thing. He, you know, he basically thought of Native Americans as part of the flora and fauna of the frontier, you know, as opposed to human beings on an equal basis with the Europeans who are encountering them. So when we talk about the middle ground now, we think we give much more not only respect, but we recognize the influence that Native Americans had in the middle ground, which is this place of contact, which as soon as that contact takes place, is no longer purely Native American, and certainly is no longer purely European either. So it's that weird mix that's taking place on the Chesapeake Bay, basically, you know, in the first decades of the 17th century. That's really fascinating, and it becomes this, you know, almost like a soup that there's all sorts of possibilities. And what's really, you know, you mentioned that sort of corporate model. What is just fascinating to me, and I think people have not paid nearly enough attention to this fact, is that these colonies were literally, you know, corporate activities, corporations, as we know them today. These are joint stock companies,
right,
that were, you know, they kind of pioneered what we think of as a publicly owned company today. And they are in essentials, basically the same thing. So these, you know, the colonists were literally entered into a contract to go on these, you know, these journeys. And this is, you know, Hobbes is not going to be writing about the social contract, you know, until the 1640s, and Locke is not going to be doing it until the 1680s. And here we are in 1610. And what we discover in that shipwreck, which happens, by the way, in Bermuda, you know, out of the middle of the Atlantic, this third resupply of Jamestown, that one is particularly fascinating because nobody lives in the Bermuda Islands. So this is an uninhabited desert archipelago that they shipwreck on. And the colonists, you know, the common settlers, almost immediately from leaving England began to get buyer's remorse because, you know, they entered into this contract with the Virginia Company based on the propaganda that had been circulating in England in 1608. And the sailors who are sailing the ships, who have, you know, these are the guys who have been back and forth to Jamestown several times by now, start telling them the truth. They tell them what's really happening over there. So by the time they shipwreck in Bermuda, they know what is in for them in Jamestown. And they come ashore and they have, you know, there's fish teeming in the lagoons. There are, you know, fowls, there's fruit that they can pluck from the trees. There's swine everywhere. There's more barbecue than they could eat for 100 years, you know. So they discover that they're in paradise, and they start theorizing and about their situation. And one guy in particular, a guy named Stephen Hopkins, starts talking about it. And we know what he said, ironically enough, because it's recorded in one of those narratives told by an executive of the Virginia Company. But it's told to us, you know, making him out to be the villain. But in doing that, his words are preserved. And what he tells his fellow castaways is that they had contracted with the Virginia Company to be delivered to Jamestown. And then they were going to give their, you know, for most of them, it was going to be a 5 or 7 year period of labor, and they were going to get land out of it at the end, and they were going to get a percentage of whatever profit came out of the company, because by going, they became a shareholder in the company. So the Virginia Company had certain obligations to them. And the fact of the shipwreck, which prevented the Virginia Company from getting them to Jamestown, the very fact of the shipwreck dissolved the contract. And this is what this guy Stephen Hopkins starts telling people, that standing in Bermuda, which is outside the jurisdiction of the Virginia Company, they don't have a charter for this place. They become political free agents. They don't have to follow the government of any man. This is what Stephen Hopkins says. And of course, what he's meaning there is the governor who's been appointed by the Virginia Company. So he tells everyone, we can just go off, we'll go off to another island. You know, there's all the, you know, hundreds of islands in the Bermuda Islands. They'll just go up to their own island and enter into some sort of they'll build a village and they'll start governing themselves according to some sort of mutual consent. And they try to do this, but they get stopped. They get, the governor gets wind of it. He drags Stephen Hopkins in front of the entire encampment, and he tries him for mutiny. He convicts him. He sentences him to death, and he reduces Stephen Hopkins to begging for his life, and really discredits him in the eyes of the other settlers. So, he kind of short circuits that attempt at what the Virginia Company calls mutiny. What you and I would call, an attempt to set up a democracy based on the notion of self-determination. But what's so fascinating to me is that he's actually even using some of the language that we're going to find in the Declaration of Independence, that we're going to find in these English political philosophers, and that eventually is going to find its way into the U.S. Constitution. So this is why I think the experience of being marooned in particular is really the foundation of American democracy. People are either literally or figuratively hurled into what they consider a wilderness. And because the leaders that have come with them prove incompetent, prove unequal to the task of successfully keeping them alive, let alone helping them thrive, they take matters into their own hands. Democracy, as some historians said in the 1950s, talking about the frontier, this frontier thesis, democracy presents itself as a necessity, as opposed to a shining beacon.
Which kind of aligns with some, I think, some anthropological work as well. It's hard to get into an idea of what is a natural state or what, how do people organize themselves, because human beings have organized themselves into various different configurations, not all of which are democratic, and there's no, it's not like there's a golden age of democracy or just because Greece was, but the idea of democracy is potentially inherent in people's conceptual framework. So in a way, what you're saying is when faced with the opportunity, many times people will gravitate, let's say, toward concepts of freedom and self-determination.
Absolutely. Yeah. They take matters into their own hands is what they do, or they die. And a lot of times they do die. They don't have the courage or the wherewithal or just, whatever the grit is that it takes to do this, often they don't, and therefore they die, but sometimes they don't. And leaders emerge out of people who would never have been leaders before. This guy, Stephen Hopkins, was a failed farmer, son of a farmer, with a little bit of education, but certainly not university educated or anything like that. He was just a regular guy, what we would describe as, a middle class person. He ends up his life as an innkeeper, and yet I think he is the most important founding father that people have never heard of, and I hope they hear of him. That's one of the things I hope this book does is spurs a lot of interest in this guy named Stephen Hopkins. John Smith is fascinating and colorful, and there's no way you can ever, steal from the glamour of a character like that. But Stephen Hopkins is just, I can't overemphasize the importance that I think he has in American history.
And doesn't he appear later in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, this is the amazing thing to me. So I think rightly, the Mayflower Compact, even though I'm trying to, suggest that we ought to look to Jamestown for our origin myth as opposed to looking to the Pilgrims. Nevertheless, I do think the Mayflower Compact, where the people on the Mayflower, on the eve of setting foot in America, enter into what they call a body politic. This is the blueprint for what is going to become the U.S. Constitution. 41 signatories who pledge to basically obey each other, obey the government that they have just formed together. That the story of that comes to us in a narrative by one of these, you know, leaders of a, you know, one of these colonial enterprises. He's not an executive of the Virginia Company, but it's William Bradford who ends up being the governor of Plymouth Plantation. So he's a leader among the Pilgrims. Now, of course, as everybody knows, on the Mayflower, it wasn't just the Pilgrims, the people that Bradford called the Saints. We call them the Pilgrims. But there was the other group of people who were not the Pilgrims, not the Saints, and Bradford called them the Strangers. And the way the Mayflower Compact ended up getting drafted, I mean, the very occasion for it, according to Bradford, is that the Strangers, who were malcontents, started whispering about this argument they had, this political argument, that because the Mayflower had sailed way north outside the jurisdiction of the Virginia Company, when they set foot ashore, they're not going to be in territory the Virginia Company has been, you know, given by the king, by the charter. So they're essentially going to be political free agents. They can do whatever they want to do. They don't have to follow the constitutions that were provided by the Virginia Company. Now, this sounds suspiciously like the argument that Stephen Hopkins was making about the shipwreck in Bermuda, right? Now, according to William Bradford, they write the Mayflower Compact in order to pull these folks in line, in order so that the Pilgrims can protect themselves from these unruly strangers. I think if we read between the lines, what we really see is that it's much more likely that the Mayflower Compact was written by the Strangers in order to protect themselves from the tyranny of the Pilgrims, because the language that is used is almost identical to the language and the philosophy behind that language that Stephen Hopkins was preaching in Bermuda. And it's no surprise that we find that, because Stephen Hopkins was on the Mayflower, and he is one of the signatories of the Mayflower Compact. You know, it's circumstantial evidence for sure, but I think it's very highly likely that Stephen Hopkins had a real major role in the drafting of the Mayflower Compact.
I think you're onto something with Stephen Hopkins. Yeah. Now, before we finish, there's just, because we've this book is full of really interesting things to talk about. I made long lists of things I wanted to ask you about, far more than we could talk about in this limited amount of time. But there is one thing that I do feel is important, and that is, you talked a lot about the relationship between the Jamestown colonists and the Indians. And I think it's very important for us to recognize the realities of the lives of the Indian people who lived there on the East Coast. I mean, for one thing, it wasn't their first contact with Europeans, because it was 1600, and Europeans had been coming there since the 1400s. So they were familiar with these ships and the guns and the kind of pugnacity of the Europeans, and their this idea that the Indians were kind of simple people, and faced with more complexly organized society, they were not able to withstand it. I think that's not accurate. I think a lot of factors go into the difficulties that Indians had in withstanding the onslaught. Part of it is just eventually population. Some of it is, as you talked about, the diseases that Europeans would get. Of course, by the time Jamestown's established, the Powhatan Confederacy was weakened by 100 years of European diseases that had affected them. But I do think you paid more attention to the Indians than many of the more European-centric stories do, and I think that's important to point out, because we've spent most of this time talking about the European side. I just didn't want it to go unsaid that your book is, very fit, kind of more balanced.
Yeah. And you talked about how, we don't often get the stories of, from the European point of view, the common folk, but we also don't get the stories, from the Native American point of view, because of course they did not write them down, right? Almost everything that we know about the Algonquin society on the Chesapeake comes from people like John Smith. You know, he wrote one of the richest, you know, almost anthropological studies of the Algonquin culture, and that's how that what we know about them is largely through that or through comparative studies. But one of the most, you know, since you brought this up, I don't know how much time we have, but I'd like to quickly mention that this guy that we know as Powhatan, which wasn't really, you know, that was more of a title than his name. So I call him Wahasunakok in the book. That's what his name was, and the way he was known among his people. And what is this guy? I mean, talk about a remarkable political figure. You know, he is, you know, the Algonquin society is basically, it's a Stone Age technology society, living in an area that there's not many stones, you know, especially as you get closer to the Atlantic, you know, maybe a little limestone, but not too much. You know, you can get some stones if you get back up towards the mountains, but you know, they have that disadvantage, and yet the sophistication of their society is immense. And he personally unifies over 30 districts. We don't know exactly how many, maybe between 30 and 40 of these local districts on the Chesapeake, almost the entire Chesapeake watershed. You have to get up to the north side of the Potomac River, you know, which is, you know, right up near the north of Chesapeake Bay to get out of his territory. So, you know, we usually think of traditional societies as, you know, being really violent places. And of course they were, you know, that part was not attractive. You know, your odds of dying violently in any traditional society in America or anywhere is way higher than in civilized society, you know, quote unquote civilized society. But what he did is he unified all these districts and essentially made a peace. You know, so there was this gigantic territory where if you are, you know, a Paspahe Indian on the James River, you can walk across this territory and go through the districts of 10 other Indian, you know, what are often called tribes. That term's kind of, you know, there's difficulty with that term, let's say, but, you know, what we popularly think of as tribes, and without getting molested at all, because he has, you know, he can go through this entire territory because Wahasunakok has personally unified all these districts. So the moment that the English ships come into the Chesapeake is actually an extraordinarily interesting political moment for Algonquin culture, because this has not happened before. So they are on the cusp of some really new and interesting political enterprise that looks like it's going to be moving towards, you know, what we would think of as a state. But of course, it doesn't get to do that because of the encounter with the English. But that is really fascinating in its own right. And as a political figure, as I say in the book, Wahasunakok is worthy of a Shakespearean play himself. You know, he could be a King Lear or a Macbeth, you know, or a Henry V might be probably the better example.
Right. Well, it is a tragedy, no matter what,
yeah.
Which character he plays. That is true. No, I love this book, and I really, really appreciate your both writing it and taking some time to talk about it.
But my pleasure. Yeah.
It's a great story, and I want to thank you for spending some time with me today.
Well, thank you, David. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
As you can see, I love talking about this stuff. I could talk about it forever.
Well, no, it's great. I wish we had more time. Well, thanks for doing it. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Joseph Kelly about Marooned, Jamestown Shipwreck, and A New History of the American Origin. And I really recommend this book to all my listeners. Thanks, Joe.